Good news! Goodwill Columbus has opened a new store in Westerville. And with a new donation center, it's easier than ever to make a difference in your community. Bring your gently used clothing, furniture, electronics, and more to our donation drop-off. Each donation and purchase supports our mission to provide jobs, free job training, essential services, and more right here in Westerville. Drop your donations off at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
The prosecution rests. The defense takes over. Patrick's mother faces a shocking cross. And finally, the experts weigh in on Lindsay Clancy's mind. This is the 13th Juror Podcast, where we unravel complex court cases, investigations, and true crime stories. From high-profile trials to the mysteries that still leave questions unanswered. We examine the facts, weigh the evidence, and explore the arguments shaping each story, just as the jurors do. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell. Today's episode is The Commonwealth of Massachusetts versus Lindsay Clancy, The Trial, Part 4. For weeks now, prosecutors have been building their case against Lindsay Clancy one witness at a time. We've heard from Patrick, we've heard from first responders, investigators, and medical examiners. We've heard from friends and family members who saw Lindsay in the months and days before January 24th. And then, of course, we spent a significant amount of time hearing from the doctors, nurses, and mental health providers who treated Lindsay as her condition seemed to get progressively worse. But this week, the prosecution reached the end of its case. And they ended it in a way that I think might make a lot of sense with the digital evidence. Prosecutors turned to the information being recorded in real time by Lindsay's phone and Apple Watch. Her Google searches, her notes, her text messages, her phone calls, her internet activity, her heart rate. Even when her devices recorded her climbing stairs. And especially as we get closer and closer to January 24th, some of that data allows us to reconstruct Lindsay's final weeks and eventually her final hours before the children were killed in incredible detail. But there's something else about this evidence that I think is really important, because although there were prosecution witnesses, some of what came out during their testimony may ultimately be just as important to the defense. And nowhere was that more obvious than when the jury got to see Lindsay's search history. On direct examination, prosecutors introduced some searches that, standing alone, certainly get your attention. For example, Googling, "Can you treat a sociopath?" just days before the children were killed. But on cross-examination, the defense zoomed way out, and suddenly, the jury wasn't looking at one disturbing Google search. They were looking at page after page after page of searches related to Lindsay's mental health, the medications that she was taking, and the symptoms she was apparently trying to understand. Benzodiazepines, trazodone, Prozac, Ativan, Seroquel, Wellbutrin, Lamictal, amitriptyline, ketamine. She was researching the medications that she had been prescribed, and their side effects, and how they could make someone feel, and what could happen when you stop taking them. But she wasn't only researching medications. Remember nurse practitioner Rebecca Gelada? Around the end of November or beginning of December, she began considering whether Lindsay could have bipolar disorder. Now, she discussed that possibility with Lindsay and Patrick, and according to Gelada, Patrick shut that idea down pretty quickly. Lindsay didn't really respond. She just sort of looked down. But her search history suggests that Lindsay may not have dismissed the possibility quite as quickly. In December, she began Googling bipolar disorder. Could bipolar disorder be temporary? Could benzodiazepines reveal bipolar disorder? What is mania? There were also searches involving postpartum depression, benzodiazepine withdrawal, and insomnia. And then, as the weeks went on, the searches changed. Schizophrenia, intrusive thoughts, psychosis, symptoms of psychosis, hallucinations. And remember what else is happening during this same period. Lindsay is cycling through medications. She's communicating with providers. She's describing herself as numb and flat. She's saying that she doesn't feel like herself, and she's trying to figure out why she isn't getting better. So when you put the searches in chronological order, the defense can point to something that looks like a progression. Medications and side effects become searches about overprescribing, and then bipolar disorder, mania, detox, ketamine therapy, suicide, more medications, schizophrenia, psychosis, problems with Seroquel, intrusive thoughts and hallucinations. And honestly, y'all, this is why context matters so much, because if all the jury heard was, can you treat a sociopath, that sounds really damaging. But when it's placed inside pages of searches about psychosis, hallucinations, suicide, and medication side effects, and treatment options, it becomes part of a much larger and much more complicated story. And all of that is actually happening alongside completely ordinary searches about her children and parenting. In other words, the digital evidence isn't giving us one clean picture. It's giving us both. And we see that same thing when you get to Lindsay's own words. Lindsay kept what essentially reads like a digital journal in the Notes app on her phone. And one particular entry gave the jury probably one of its clearest windows that we've had into how Lindsay herself described motherhood and her mental health during this period. The entire note was read aloud in court.
I'm sad and depressed because I am not able to parent my third child like my first. I want to treat any one of my babies like my first, but I know that's not a feasible possibility. I'm sad that I stopped breastfeeding. I feel not as connected with Cal now.
Throughout this note, Lindsay writes about an enormous amount of guilt surrounding motherhood. She feels guilty that she can't give Callan the same experience that she gave Cora. She feels guilty about sleep training him, guilty about stopping breastfeeding, guilty that caring for Cora and Dawson takes attention away from Callan, and guilty that caring for Callan prevents her from being completely present with Cora and Dawson. There seemed to be no parenting decision that she could make that didn't become another reason for her to criticize herself. And there's one line in particular that's pretty jarring, especially knowing what eventually happens. Lindsay writes that she sort of resents her older children because they prevent her from treating Callan the way that she treated her first baby. Then immediately, she recognizes that for what it is and writes, "I know that's not fair to them. I know that." And when you read the rest of the note, she isn't describing wanting to get away from her children. Quite the opposite. She talks about still wanting another baby. She says Callan was so very planned and desired. She wants to sign him up for baby music classes. Maybe Fridays could become their special day together. She wants to enjoy spending time with Patrick again. She wants to sleep. And more than anything, she keeps coming back to the same thing. She just wants to feel happy again. And then she says she's terrified of something happening to her kids or doing something wrong to mess up their development. For the last 5 years, she's just filled her mind with all things parenting, and it's just unhealthy. And that line to me puts so much of what we've heard throughout this trial into context, because witness after witness has described Lindsay as an incredibly attentive mother. But here, Lindsay herself is saying that this intense focus on parenting had become unhealthy for her. At one point, she tells her mother that she's basically hanging in there just waiting for the day that she wakes up and feels like herself again. And then we get to January 24th. For most of that day, Lindsay's digital activity looks pretty ordinary. That morning, she's communicating with Patrick about taking one of the children to the doctor. She's taking pictures of the kids playing outside in the snow. And she sends one to Patrick, who responds, "You're a good mama." By late afternoon, they're talking about dinner. Lindsay suggests takeout, and she asks Patrick to stop at CVS. She's searching for Pedialax for one of the children, and around 5:10 p.m., she places the takeout order. Around 5:15, Patrick leaves the house. Now, this is where the timeline gets incredibly important, because for roughly the next 45 minutes, Lindsay is inside that house with the children, while Patrick's movements away from the home can be independently tracked. And when Patrick comes back, he walks into the nightmare that we've spent this entire trial talking about. So what does the digital evidence tell us about those 45 minutes? At 5:23:52 p.m., about 8 minutes after Patrick leaves, Lindsay's Apple Watch records her heart rate for the final time that day, 57 beats per minute. After that, there are no more heart rate readings from the watch. Now, we don't know specifically why the data stops recording at this point. It could presumably be because the watch was taken off, especially because we know investigators would later find that Apple Watch inside of a nightstand drawer, but prosecutors pointed out that it could also be because it died. So take that for what you will. But at 5:23 p.m., that's an interesting point in this timeline because that's when the watch stops giving us the heart rate data, but Lindsay's phone keeps recording activity. At approximately 5:33 p.m., while Patrick is at CVS, he calls Lindsay. She doesn't answer, but she calls him back pretty much right away, and the two speak for about 14 seconds. After that, calls go unanswered. And according to the digital evidence presented in court, Lindsay's phone is never unlocked again. Then, during almost that exact same window, between about 5:33 and 5:38, the health data from Lindsay's phone records activity categorized as climbing two flights of stairs. And that is potentially significant because we already know where this ends. The children will ultimately be found downstairs in the basement, and Lindsay will ultimately be found outside beneath an upstairs window. And her phone is recording vertical movement during that narrow window between Patrick leaving the house and returning home. But we have to be very precise about what that evidence actually proves. It doesn't tell us which staircase was climbed. It doesn't tell us who was holding the phone. It doesn't tell us whether those two recorded flights represent one continuous movement or separate movements. And it certainly doesn't tell us that a particular child was harmed at a particular time. But what it gives prosecutors is movement. Movement during a period when Patrick is documented away from the house. Movement shortly after the last recorded heart rate from Lindsay's Apple Watch, and movement around the same time that Patrick is trying to reach her. That movement inside that window of time is when prosecutors contend that these children were killed. The Commonwealth is asking the jury to take that data and put it together with everything else that they've heard. The location of the children, the scene in the basement, the blood evidence upstairs, the open bedroom window, Lindsay's injuries, Patrick's movements, the phone calls, all of that, and decide what those final pieces tell them about what happened inside that house. And really, that's how the prosecution chose to end its case. They started this trial by telling the jury what they believe Lindsay Clancy did. Then, witness by witness, they reconstructed the months, days, hours, and eventually minutes that led up to it. And with that, the Commonwealth rested. We'll be right back.
No data, no AI. It's just that simple. Until now, the data your AI depends on has been trapped behind ever-increasing cloud fees. Wasabi created Hot Cloud Storage and is redefining cloud storage for the AI era, delivering simple, predictable cloud storage for AI, analytics, media, and more. Your data is free to move, fast to access, and ready when your AI needs it, giving your business a competitive advantage. When your data moves freely, innovation moves faster, giving you the freedom to build, train, and do more with your data. Hidden fees add up fast as AI workloads grow. Wasabi's flat pricing eliminates all of it. One rate, no surprises. With global scale, enterprise performance, and predictable pricing, Wasabi helps organizations focus on innovation instead of cloud bills. Companies that are paying more in fees than in actual storage costs can fall behind. Don't let it happen. When your AI needs your data and you have a budget to meet, get Wasabi. Learn more and try now for free at wasabi.com. Wasabi, the AI storage cloud. Proud partner of the iHeart Podcast Network.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
When the defense began its case, they started with some of the people who knew Lindsay best. Her family, her friends, and people who had worked alongside her for years. And what was interesting is that in many ways, their descriptions of Lindsay weren't different from what we had already heard from the prosecution's witnesses. Before all of this, Lindsay Clancy was described as a good nurse and a good mom. Margaret, one of Lindsay's former coworkers, described her as passionate about nursing and kind and a strong advocate for her patients, the kind of nurse that you would want taking care of you or someone you loved. And when Lindsay became a mom, Margaret said she was constantly asking her coworkers questions about parenting and childcare. Even when Lindsay was working overnight shifts at the hospital, she would pull up the cameras at home to check on her children while they slept. There was actually one night when Lindsay checked the camera and saw Cora crying. She tried calling Patrick and couldn't reach him, so she became so worried that something might be wrong that she eventually called the police and asked them to do a wellness check. Everyone was fine, but it gives you an idea of just how concerned and attentive she could be when it came to her kids. But Margaret also told the jury about a conversation from years earlier that, knowing what eventually happened, is hard not to stop and think about. When Lindsay was a relatively new nurse, they had a patient who was having thoughts of harming herself. That led Margaret and Lindsay into a conversation about mental health, pregnancy, and postpartum issues. And eventually, Margaret brought up Andrea Yates. If you're not familiar with Andrea Yates, she was a Texas mother who drowned her 5 children in 2001 while suffering from severe postpartum mental illness and psychosis. Yates was initially convicted of capital murder, but that conviction was later overturned, and at her 2006 retrial, a jury found her not guilty by reason of insanity. She was committed to a state psychiatric hospital where she remains today. Lindsay apparently had never heard of that case before, so Margaret explained it to her. And this was Lindsay's reaction.
And I asked her if she had ever heard of the Andrea Yates case, and she hadn't. And I explained that to her, and she cried. And she said, how could a mother hurt her children?
Knowing what would happen years later, it's hard not to hear that moment differently now. Then the defense brought in the women who knew Lindsay not just as a nurse or coworker, but as a mother. Her own mother described Lindsay as loving and dedicated. She said that Lindsay had always wanted to be a mom, and becoming a mother was the best thing that had ever happened to her, and she would have done anything for her children. Patrick's mother, Sue, described essentially the same woman: nurturing, loving, a wonderful mother who loved all 3 of her children. And again, what's striking about this testimony is that this really isn't something the two sides disagree about. We heard versions of it throughout the prosecution's case, too. Before the months leading up to January 24th, witness after witness has described a woman who loved her children and was devoted to them. And I think that's exactly why the defense started here. But then the defense didn't bring these witnesses in just to tell the jury who Lindsay had always been. They also wanted them to describe the changes that they watched happen. And Lindsay's mom gave us a pretty clear dividing line. She said that summer of 2022 was good. She was seeing Lindsay regularly. Lindsay and Patrick were active with the kids, and she didn't notice anything concerning. But by October, something had changed. Lindsay had become increasingly anxious. She wasn't sleeping. She was struggling with the idea of returning to work and leaving Callan. And then, on October 20th, she sent her mom a message asking her to come stay with her.
Mom, will you please come up and stay with me for a bit? I'm really sick. Something is wrong. I had horrible insomnia all night, and I just don't know how I'm going to get through the day. I started taking the medicine my doctor prescribed for anxiety, and I think it's made things worse. It's just really scary, and I don't want to be alone.
Her mom came that day, and from there, what had been occasional visits became something very different. Her parents were staying for extended periods throughout November and December. Patrick's parents were helping too. The family was increasingly surrounding Lindsay and helping with the children because, according to these witnesses, she wasn't getting any better. By late November, Lindsay was so afraid to be alone that one night she asked her mom if she could sleep with her. By Christmas, her sister Allison said that Lindsay told her that she was numb, hopeless, scared, and didn't feel like herself. She said she had been experiencing suicidal thoughts every day for about a month. And then we heard something particularly important from Lindsay's mom, because this pushes the timeline of Lindsay having thoughts about harming the children back before January 24th. She testified that sometime in December, Lindsay was standing in the kitchen with her and Patrick when Lindsay became very nervous and said, "I have to tell you something."
I remember her being very nervous. I remember her saying, "I just have to tell you guys something." And then she told us.
What did she tell you?
She told us that she had thoughts of harming the children.
Now, that is very significant because one of the questions hanging over this trial has been when these thoughts actually began. The defense now has testimony from someone who says that Lindsay disclosed thoughts of harming the children weeks before they were killed. There were moments when things appeared to improve. Lindsay voluntarily admitted herself to McLean, and after she was discharged, there was some hope that maybe they were finally moving in the right direction. But according to her family, by January, she still wasn't Lindsay. At Cora's birthday party on January 7th, Allison described her as just going through the motions. Her mom said that Lindsay had lost significant weight, had developed fears that didn't seem logical, she didn't want to drive, and she was struggling with her memory. And yet, through all of this, they said that Lindsay continued seeing doctors, trying medications, and trying to function as a mother. By late January, Lindsay told her mom that she felt like the medications were destroying her mind. But what she wanted, according to her family, was actually very simple. She wanted to get better. She wanted to feel like herself again. And she wanted to be able to enjoy her children again. And I think Sue Clancy probably summed up the defense's entire point with this testimony.
She was begging for help.
That is the picture that the defense wanted these witnesses to leave the jury with. Not a woman who suddenly decided on January 24th that she wanted to kill her children, but a woman that they say they watched deteriorate for months while repeatedly trying to get help. The question, of course, is whether that deterioration ultimately amounted to the kind of mental disease or defect required under Massachusetts law. And that is where the defense's experts became so important. We'll be right back.
No data, no AI. It's just that simple. Until now, the data your AI depends on has been trapped behind ever-increasing cloud fees. Wasabi created Hot Cloud Storage and is redefining cloud storage for the AI era, delivering simple, predictable cloud storage for AI, analytics, media, and more. Your data is free to move, fast to access, and ready when your AI needs it, giving your business a competitive advantage. When your data moves freely, innovation moves faster, giving you the freedom to build, train, and do more with your data. Hidden fees add up fast as AI workloads grow. Wasabi's flat pricing eliminates all of it. One rate, no surprises. With global scale, enterprise performance, and predictable pricing, Wasabi helps organizations focus on innovation instead of cloud bills. Companies that are paying more in fees than in actual storage costs can fall behind. Don't let it happen. When your AI needs your data and you have a budget to meet, get Wasabi. Learn more and try now for free at wasabi.com. Wasabi, the AI storage cloud. Proud partner of the iHeart Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The defense called emergency medicine physician Dr. Michael Volfovich and forensic pathologist Dr. Elizabeth Lapisotta. That name might sound familiar. She was also one of the experts that testified in the Karen Reed case. And while both of these doctors acknowledged that some of the cuts to Lindsay's wrists and neck were superficial, they also explained that others were not. Some extended into the tissue beneath the skin, damaging blood vessels and causing significant bleeding. Dr. Lapisotta also identified what she believed were hesitation marks, something that can be seen in people attempting suicide. And then there was the fall from the second-story window. Dr. Lapisotta testified that the physical evidence was consistent with Lindsay putting her hand on the windowsill and pushing herself out, essentially going head first toward the ground. The impact caused devastating injuries to her spine, including a burst fracture at the very top of her neck. At the hospital, she was in spinal shock and hypothermic, and at one point, she coded. So the defense's point here was pretty straightforward. Whatever you believe about Lindsay's state of mind when she killed the children, these experts say what happened immediately afterward was consistent with serious attempt to take her own life. But the injuries on Lindsay are really only one piece of this, because the much bigger question for the defense is what was happening inside Lindsay's mind. And this week, we finally begin hearing expert testimony about that, too. So, now we get to what I think is really the heart of the defense's case, the mental health experts. And rather than go witness by witness, I want to organize this around the questions that these experts are actually being asked to answer. Because after weeks of testimony about symptoms, medications, doctors, and diagnoses, there are still some pretty fundamental questions hanging over this case. The first one, do we even know what was wrong with her?
Throughout this trial, we've heard diagnosis of anxiety and depression, but the defense experts say that there were other possibilities that should have been considered, including bipolar disorder and postpartum psychosis. Dr. Donald Condi, a clinical and forensic psychiatrist, explained why bipolar disorder mattered here.
Bipolar is the newer name for what used to be called manic depressive illness. It describes an illness where people's moods go up, which is the manic phase, and then go down, which is the depressed phase. There are different categories of bipolar disorder. Bipolar 1 is the most serious. Bipolar 2 disorder also has similar fluctuations of mood. But in both cases of bipolar disorder, most people spend more time being depressed than they do being manic.
And remember, this isn't something that the defense invented after the fact. Based on Lindsay's reaction to the SSRIs and her specific symptoms that she was reporting, Nurse Gelada was actually considering bipolar disorder while Lindsay was being treated. Condi testified that depression can be a prominent part of bipolar disorder, and suicidal ideation can accompany it. He points out that suicidal ideation was prominent in Lindsay's medical records for those months. And that potential diagnosis matters when you look at Lindsay's treatment, because antidepressants, particularly SSRIs, can require additional caution in someone with bipolar disorder because of the risk of triggering or worsening the mania. So, did Lindsay's providers miss this diagnosis? Potential issues with her treatment has been an overall theme of this entire trial, and Dr. Condi was critical of how sparse some of the records were, particularly Dr. Tuff's records. He noted that many of them consisted largely of checkboxes, like just going through the motions, checking she's feeling this, she did this, but there's no extensive narrative documenting what happened during those appointments. And, like they mentioned before, every single one of those appointments was through telehealth. He also pointed to basic medical workups that apparently weren't done, including blood work and thyroid testing. That's very relevant for postpartum mothers, because physical conditions like anemia or thyroid dysfunction can produce symptoms that overlap with psychiatric complaints. That includes fatigue or sleep problems, anxiety, and mood changes, all of which Lindsay reported. And all of this feeds into that larger defense argument that we've been hearing throughout this trial. Lindsay kept asking for help, but nobody ever stepped back, assembled the entire picture, and figured out exactly what was happening to her. The defense's expert took a very different and much more involved approach. Dr. Zeisel has met with Lindsay more than 60 times, mostly in person, meaning he has spent significantly more time evaluating her than many of the providers who treated her before January 24th. And he ultimately reached a very different diagnosis than just anxiety or depression. And this brings us to the heart of the defense's case, postpartum psychosis. One thing that's important to understand is that postpartum psychosis doesn't necessarily look like what most of us picture when we hear the word psychotic. And that became evident as these experts testified. They said it can involve severe depression and anxiety, confusion, agitation, racing thoughts and insomnia, but also hallucinations, delusions, dissociation, and periods of increased energy or hypomania. In other words, it can be much more complicated and much less obvious from the outside than someone simply appearing disconnected from reality. During the last 4 weeks, prosecutors have repeatedly pointed to Lindsay's ability to function as evidence against psychosis. She made phone calls and sounded normal. She could drive, use her phone, search Google, and order food. Her speech wasn't slurred. She could think toward a goal. There were moments when, from the outside, she appeared completely normal. But according to the defense experts, none of that necessarily rules out psychosis. Dr. Condi explained that psychosis can be episodic. It doesn't necessarily mean that someone is completely detached from reality every minute of every day.
Would you agree with me that you don't have to see the proverbial unicorn in the corner to your health provider to be suffering from psychosis?
Yes, that's true.
And can you tell us, counsel was asking about the symptomology, psychosis, is that something that just grinds on for day after week after month, or is that something that comes on out of nowhere very quickly?
No, overall.
It can be quite episodic.
What does that mean?
It means that an episode can start and stop, and then an interval of time goes by. It could be days, weeks, or months, and then another episode occurs.
And Dr. Zeisel gave an analogy that I thought made this particularly easy to understand. He described psychotic symptoms almost like waves coming onto a beach. They can come and go.
People with psychoses have intermittent symptoms. They can function fine one day, and the next day they can be hearing voices. They could be seeing things, feeling things, smelling things. To be clear, those additional types of hallucinations did not plague Ms. Clancy. She only had auditory hallucinations. But hallucinations are like the waves at the beach. They come and go.
They're called waxing and waning?
Yes.
And importantly, Zeisel said that even while someone is experiencing psychosis, they can still perform ordinary, purposeful tasks. They can drive a car. They can carry on a conversation. They can look up directions, search a menu, and use their phone.
Can you tell us, is a person, even if they are in the throes of psychosis, are they able to make a phone call?
Yes, they can.
Are they able to drive a car?
Yes.
Are they able to say, hi, Hawaii, I'd like to have a hot dog?
Yes.
Now, this has been a huge argument for the prosecution. So just to make sure that the jurors hear what he's putting out there, Reddington asked Zeisel again.
Is it your understanding to a reasonable degree of medical certainty that a person who's in a psychotic state is able to drive a car for a short distance, go to an appointment, and interact and talk to people?
Yes, they can do everyday tasks of living.
So the fact that she's not talking about the unicorns in the corner, and she's not slurring her speech, and she's not unable to walk, to your opinion, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, does that mean that she's not in a psychotic state?
It does not.
I think this is a very important distinction in this case. The prosecution has repeatedly pointed to Lindsay's ability to function, plan, and complete ordinary tasks as evidence that she was thinking rationally. The defense is saying that those things are not mutually exclusive. According to their experts, the fact that Lindsay could function in certain moments does not, by itself, tell us whether she was also experiencing psychosis. And another question that we have to rely on the experts to answer is, was Lindsay faking it? Could Lindsay have been exaggerating or even fabricating these symptoms? And this is where Zeisel's role as a psychologist becomes particularly important. Psychological evaluations can include methods specifically designed to look for malingering, inconsistent responses, and symptom exaggeration. And after evaluating Lindsay, Zeisel gave the jury his opinion. He said that he found no evidence that Lindsay was malingering or faking her symptoms. Now, that's important, but it still doesn't answer the ultimate question, because Lindsay could have been genuinely mentally ill and still be criminally responsible for killing her children. And that distinction brings us to the question that this entire trial is ultimately about. We'll be right back.
In today's world, planning ahead isn't always top of mind, but not having life insurance can leave families facing difficult financial uncertainty during already emotional times. In many cases, loved ones are left managing expenses, debts, or long-term obligations without a clear plan in place. Life insurance is one way to help provide financial security and support when it's needed most. That's where Ethos comes in. Ethos makes getting life insurance fast and easy, and it's 100% online. You can get a quote within seconds, apply in minutes, and even get same-day coverage. There's no medical exam. You just answer a few simple health questions online, and coverage options are flexible with up to $3 million available and some policies starting at around $30 a month. Ethos has also earned strong customer feedback with a 4.9 out of 5-star rating on Trustpilot based on more than 5,500 reviews as of August 2026. Help protect your family with life insurance through Ethos. Get your instant quote today at ethos.com. That's ETHOS.com. Application times and rates may vary.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for The New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's The Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.
Defense attorney Kevin Reddington told this jury in opening statements that ultimately the case comes down to one question: what was happening inside Lindsey Clancy's mind? And after 16 days of testimony, we finally heard from the defense experts who were trying to answer it. But before we can understand their opinion about Lindsey, we first need to understand something much more fundamental. What does it actually mean to be psychotic?
Well, psychosis in general just means a lack of understanding of what's real as opposed to what is not. So a person with psychosis can have delusions, which are fixed false beliefs. They could believe that, for example, they have been told by God to do something. They can also have hallucinations at times.
What kind of hallucinations?
Most people have auditory hallucinations, not auditory visual hallucinations.
Hearing. Is that correct? Auditory is hearing, right?
Yes.
Okay, as opposed to what?
As opposed to visual hallucinations?
Visual.
Once you know what the experts are actually looking for to diagnose psychosis, the defense argues that there are things scattered throughout Lindsey's history that suddenly become much more significant. Dr. Paul Zeisel, clinical and forensic psychologist, talked about Lindsey describing thoughts that became so loud and overwhelming, she believed that other people could hear them, even strangers.
She said she had, quote, horrible thoughts, unquote. She felt that people could actually hear her thoughts. The thoughts were so loud that strangers could hear them.
Did sometimes she express at that point, for example, that she was concerned about school teachers with the little Sprouts school with the kids, that they could read her thoughts and that she would lose custody?
Yes, it's called ideas of reference. You believe other people can hear what you're thinking, and that can have a very negative interpretation for the person believing that, feeling that, and thinking that the outcome is going to be a negative one, that their children may be relieved from their care.
Delusions can be a symptom of psychosis, and that experience that the doctor just explained is consistent with a delusional belief sometimes described as thought broadcasting. There were also references in her records to dissociation and derealization, feeling disconnected from reality or as though the things around you aren't real. For example, on November 29th, Gelada's records actually reference depression along with psychotic symptoms of dissociation. And then, of course, there's the most disputed symptom of all, the auditory hallucination that Lindsey said she heard the night that she killed the children. Dr. Zeisel testified about a visit with Lindsey in the hospital after the killings. During that visit, Lindsey asked if she could use his phone to call Patrick. Zeisel was sitting there while they spoke, so he heard Lindsey describe to Patrick, in her own words, what she said had happened that night and what the voice had told her to do.
She had told Patrick that she loved him very much. She was unable to express a lot of emotion, but she expressed love for him. And she had said that she heard a male voice ordering her, telling her that she didn't have any choice, but she had to kill her children and then kill herself.
Now, this moment is where everything that we've spent weeks talking about finally comes together. The medications matter. The insomnia matters. The suicidal thoughts matter. The possible delusions and dissociation matters. The deterioration her family says they watched happen matters. But none of those things, standing alone, answer the legal question. The jury has to determine what Lindsay's mental condition meant at the time that she killed Cora, Dawson, and Callan, including whether, because of mental disease or defect, she lacked the substantial capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness of what she was doing or conform her conduct to the requirements of the law. And eventually, Zeisel was asked directly for his opinion on that.
So can you tell this jury, sir, in your opinion, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, based upon all of what you have reviewed, all of what we have talked about, all of what you have considered, as to whether or not at the time of this incident resulting in the killing of these three little kids, that she was suffering from a mental disease or defect, such as that she lost substantial capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness of her act, or in the disjunctive, was unable to conform her conduct to the requirements of the law?
Yes.
Tell the jury what your opinion is, please.
My opinion is that she did have indeed a mental disease or a defect. That's a legal construct, not a DSM-5 one, but she had bipolar disorder with postpartum psychoses. In addition, she was unable to conform her behaviors to the rule of law, and she had no appreciation for the wrongfulness of her act.
And there it is. That's the defense case in its simplest form. They aren't asking this jury to believe that Lindsay didn't kill her children. They're asking the jury to believe that the woman who did it on January 24th was profoundly different from the mother we heard described at the beginning of their case, and that by the time she killed her children, mental illness had progressed to the point that she was no longer criminally responsible for what she was doing. So for now, that's where the defense case stands. They're expected to call a few more witnesses before arresting, and then the prosecution will have an opportunity to present rebuttal evidence. But before we close out this week's episode, we need to talk about some of the biggest moments that happened on cross-examination, because a few of those exchanges may have helped the prosecution, while others may have just done the opposite. One common theme with the Commonwealth this week was really just playing the blame game with multiple members of Lindsay's family. They asked her mother, her sister, and her mother-in-law some version of the same question. Basically, if they were so concerned about Lindsay, why didn't they report her or try to have her committed or take some other kind of emergency action? The implication seems to be that if the people closest to Lindsay didn't believe that she needed that level of intervention at the time, then maybe her condition wasn't as severe as the defense is now claiming. Now, look, I struggle with this line of questioning. Lindsay was already seeing mental health professionals. She went to the ER. She was hospitalized. If the people trained to recognize serious mental illness didn't see a reason to have her committed, how can we expect her family to have recognized something that the professionals may have missed? Her family can tell us what they saw, but I don't think that their failure to recognize a psychiatric emergency necessarily proves there wasn't one. Prosecutors also pushed back on the idea that Lindsay was steadily deteriorating, arguing that there were actually signs that she was getting better. They pointed to text messages and conversations where Lindsay said she was feeling a little bit better, or where her mom commented that it was good to see her doing better. They also highlighted conversations with family members immediately after January 24th, when some said that they thought Lindsay seemed okay, or, you guessed it, better, in the days leading up to it. Now, I understand where prosecutors are going with that argument, and I do think that those conversations are relevant, but I don't think that they necessarily tell us as much as the prosecution wants them to. Mental illness doesn't really follow a straight line. Someone can have a good day or a good conversation and still be struggling significantly overall. So to me, she seemed better that day is very different from she was well. Those moments may be pieces of the overall picture, but they don't necessarily tell us what was happening in Lindsay's mind on January 24th. Prosecutors have also pointed to certain behaviors to suggest that Lindsay's symptoms may not have been as severe as they seemed. For example, when she went to the emergency department on November 16th for heart palpitations, they pointed out that she had taken a THC gummy the night before, which could potentially explain the palpitations. They also emphasized that she was able to drive herself there and back home. Now, they've made a similar argument. Personally, cherry-picking symptoms here and there and giving potential other causes doesn't really diminish the severity of the symptoms that she continued to report for months. But that will be for jurors to decide. Prosecutors made a similar argument about sleep, pointing out that Lindsay wouldn't let the kids sleep at Patrick's house overnight, even though that could have given her a chance to sleep. And look, I understand what prosecutors are trying to do with that. They're essentially saying, if Lindsay was truly this desperate for sleep, why would she turn down an opportunity to get it? But I think they took that argument a little too far during their questioning of Sue Clancy. There was a whole line of questioning about Patrick's parents offering to have the kids stay overnight and Lindsay not wanting them to. And to me, that just doesn't prove very much. There are plenty of parents, especially parents of very young children, who may desperately need sleep and still not be comfortable having their kids spend the night somewhere else. Those two things can exist at the same time. And more than that, I thought the way that prosecutors pushed Sue on that was a really big misstep. This is a grandmother who lost three grandchildren, and at a certain point, the questioning started to feel almost accusatory toward her, as though she should have done more or should have somehow overridden Lindsay and taken the children away. I'm not sure what that accomplishes for the prosecution. Prosecutors also pointed out that Julie Paul was the only one of Lindsay's providers who wasn't named in the civil lawsuit, and Julie Paul also happened to be someone that Sue had personally referred her to. The implication seemed pretty clear. They were suggesting that Sue's personal connection to Paul influenced who the family chose to sue, or that the lawsuit itself may be selective or biased. It's another attempt to challenge Sue's objectivity, but again, Sue wasn't the person making Lindsay's diagnoses or determining her criminal responsibility. And y'all, it only got worse from there. There was another exchange with Sue that stood out to me because, once again, I found myself wondering, what exactly are we trying to prove here? Prosecutors asked Sue about her relationship with Lindsay and whether she was aware that Lindsay had apparently told her therapist that she wasn't particularly close with Sue. Listen to what she said.
And are you aware that Lindsay told one of the therapists that she wasn't close with you as in-laws?
And that she, I didn't know that, no.
That she said she doesn't generally allow the in-laws to watch her children?
I did watch the kids.
Okay, but are you aware that she told the therapist that?
No.
Are you aware she told the therapist that she didn't have any particular reason why and that they don't bug me about it either?
I didn't know any of that.
Okay, this one felt less like a murder trial and more like somebody had just pulled out screenshots from a middle school group chat. Because what does this actually establish? Maybe Lindsay didn't feel as close to Sue as Sue believed they were. Okay, relationships are subjective. Two people can have completely different perceptions of how close they are, and neither one necessarily has to be lying. Plus, there were journal entries that were introduced where Lindsay specifically says how grateful she is for Sue. But more importantly, how does that help this jury decide Lindsay's criminal responsibility on January 24th? It just struck me as unnecessarily petty. Instead of undermining Sue on something substantive, you're essentially telling this grieving grandmother, well, Lindsay told her therapist that she wasn't actually close to you. Maybe the prosecution has a larger purpose for it that becomes clear later, but standing on its own, I'm just not sure what they gained from that exchange, and I think there's a real possibility that they lost more with the jury than they gained. But those moments pale in comparison to the one moment during cross-examination where everything completely went off the rails. We'll be right back.
No data, no AI. It's just that simple. Until now, the data your AI depends on has been trapped behind ever-increasing cloud fees. Wasabi created Hot Cloud Storage and is redefining cloud storage for the AI era, delivering simple, predictable cloud storage for AI, analytics, media, and more. Your data is free to move, fast to access, and ready when your AI needs it, giving your business a competitive advantage. When your data moves freely, innovation moves faster, giving you the freedom to build, train, and do more with your data. Hidden fees add up fast as AI workloads grow. Wasabi's flat pricing eliminates all of it. One rate, no surprises. With global scale, enterprise performance, and predictable pricing, Wasabi helps organizations focus on innovation instead of cloud bills. Companies that are paying more in fees than in actual storage costs can fall behind. Don't let it happen. When your AI needs your data and you have a budget to meet, get Wasabi. Learn more and try now for free at wasabi.com. Wasabi, the AI storage cloud. Proud partner of the iHeart Podcast Network.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
There may have been some bad moments during Sue Clancy's cross-examination with the prosecution, but at the risk of sounding like one of those old infomercials, I gotta say it. But wait, there's more. Prosecutors push Sue even further during cross-examination, and this is where, for me, things really started to go sideways. Because after questioning this grieving grandmother about why the children didn't stay the night at her house or whether she knew that Lindsay had talked about her, the prosecution moved into a line of questioning about religion. Sue had testified about the family's Catholic faith and about how they went to Mass on Christmas Day. And I want you to hear for yourself where the prosecutor went with that.
Now, are you an active member in the Catholic Church?
Yes.
Okay. So you're aware that murder is considered a mortal sin?
Counsel, can I see you over here?
So not only is this line of questioning irrelevant, it is wildly inappropriate. And prosecutors had to have known that. And remember, this is Massachusetts, where Catholicism has deep roots and remains much more prevalent than it is nationally. So this isn't necessarily an abstract religious concept to the people sitting in that jury box. It could be taken as an attempt at jury nullification, as if to remind jurors who may be Catholic that they shouldn't vote not guilty because murder is a mortal sin. That is wild to me. And y'all, this is one of those moments where I genuinely wonder whether the prosecution may have lost some jurors. Maybe they were trying to make the argument that if Lindsay shared those religious beliefs, then perhaps it goes toward whether she understood that killing her children was morally wrong. I don't know, but Sue Clancy isn't Lindsay. Sue's religious beliefs don't establish what Lindsay believed, and they certainly don't tell us what was happening in Lindsay's mind on January 24th. After everything that this woman has already lost, putting her in a position where she is essentially being asked to acknowledge that the killing of her own grandchildren is a mortal sin felt unnecessarily harsh to me. And jurors are human. They notice not only what attorneys are trying to prove, but how they treat the people sitting in that witness chair. You can have a legally relevant point and still lose people in the way you choose to make it. I don't know what the legally relevant point here was, but this sure did feel like one of those moments where you lose people. And that tone that we just saw with Sue didn't disappear when prosecution moved on to the expert witnesses. Cross-examination of Dr. LaPosada got a little spicy at times. The prosecutor clearly wanted control of this cross-examination, and we got one of those moments that we've seen a time or two in this trial and other trials, where the witness tries to explain an answer and the response is basically, "I'm the one asking questions." But there was another moment during this cross that I think may have actually backfired on the prosecution. The prosecutor questioned Dr. LaPosada about testimony that she had given in a previous case involving strangulation. And the point that she seemed to really want this jury to hear was about how long strangulation takes. Dr. Lapisotta explained that depending on the method, a person can lose consciousness relatively quickly, within seconds. But unconsciousness is not the same thing as death. The prosecutor focused on the fact that pressure would generally have to continue for another couple of minutes after unconsciousness to cause death. And I think we can understand why the state wants that in front of this jury. Their argument is essentially, think about the process required to do this to three separate children. But Dr. Lapisotta explained something else. She said that if the exercise bands were tied or secured around the children's necks, the bands themselves could potentially maintain that pressure. And the prosecutor apparently did not like where that answer was going.
And you're not aware, there's been no testimony, no evidence, nothing showing that they were knotted and left there, correct? No. They weren't tied in a knot and left around their necks, according to any of the evidence, correct?
Okay, except y'all know me. I take notes. I have an entire spreadsheet of these witnesses day by day. And the second she said that, I remembered Pat's testimony because I remember Patrick specifically talking about untying those bands. So I went back and double checked myself. And sure enough.
And do you recall how you got the band off?
I think I untied it.
So the bands were tied. And the reason that matters is because Dr. Lapisotta had just explained that if they were tied in any type of way that made them secure, they could maintain pressure without someone physically holding that pressure the entire time. Patrick did go on to say that he couldn't remember exactly how they were tied, so the prosecutor asked him about his previous statements that he had given to remind him.
Do you recall describing it previously as when you initially tie your shoes but then don't do the bow?
Yeah, that sounds right.
So here's evidence and testimony that the bands were tied, and the prosecutor snaps back at this witness saying that there is no evidence or testimony that they were tied. I thought, well, maybe she's specifically referring to a knot, but Dr. Lapisotta said that being in a knot doesn't matter.
The important part to me was they were wrapped several times, and then whether it had a bow or a knot would not really be important. It was secure and wrapped around the neck several times.
Now, she wasn't saying exactly how it happened. Her point here was that medically, the pressure could potentially be maintained that way, regardless of how precisely the bands were tied. So instead of undermining her testimony, I thought this exchange actually highlighted something that the prosecution probably didn't want highlighted. And then Patrick's own testimony appeared to support the premise of her answer. And at that point, I was just sitting there thinking, what are we doing here? But I do want to be fair here, because there were points that the prosecution made during cross-examinations that I did think helped their case. One of the biggest was the timing of the alleged voice. The defense has emphasized that Lindsay said that she heard a male voice telling her to kill the children, but prosecutors pointed out that based on the records and testimony that we've heard, the first documented time that Lindsay ever reported hearing that voice was after the children were killed. There doesn't appear to be a report before January 24th of Lindsay hearing voices or receiving commands to harm her children. And if the defense is asking this jury to believe that that voice was part of the psychosis driving what happened that night, I think that timing is absolutely something that the prosecution is entitled to and should challenge. Dr. Zeisel acknowledged that nowhere in Lindsay's medical records from September through January did she report hearing a voice telling her to kill herself or the children. She had reported suicidal thoughts and intrusive thoughts, but the voice itself does not appear in those records. And according to the testimony, Lindsay has not heard that voice again since January 24th. That was probably one of the stronger points that the prosecution made. But the defense does have an answer to that. Their experts have explained that not reporting something doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't happening, particularly when you're talking about a mother experiencing thoughts or voices involving harm to her own children. There can be a very real fear that if you tell a doctor, hey, I'm hearing a voice telling me to hurt my kids, that someone's going to take those kids away from you, or hospitalize you, or otherwise intervene. So I think both sides have a legitimate argument here. That'll be up for jurors. Prosecutors also went after Dr. Zeisel himself, raising the possibility of confirmation bias and questioning whether he had crossed the line between being an independent forensic examiner and becoming an advocate for Lindsay. Zeisel agreed that an evaluator has to guard against confirmation bias and said, essentially, that you have to let the facts lead you rather than go looking for facts that support your conclusion. But prosecutors pointed out that Zeisel had referred to Lindsay as his patient, had written a letter requesting accommodations for her, appeared at court hearings at the defense's request, and even participated in a news conference early in this case. So the prosecution's larger argument on cross seemed to be twofold. There is no record supporting one of the most important psychotic symptoms Lindsay later described. And the expert now telling this jury that she was psychotic may have become too closely aligned with the defense to be completely objective. Now, those are both issues that I think the jury is going to have to weigh when deciding how much credibility to give Dr. Zeisel's ultimate opinion. And finally, there was an interesting tug of war over who Lindsay is today and what her life looks like now. Prosecutors pulled records from the state-run hospital where Lindsay is being held, documenting what Lindsay was doing on some particularly significant dates, her children's birthdays, and the anniversary of January 24th. They pointed to notes showing her eating snacks, watching TV, using her phone, socializing, and going about her routine. And I found myself wondering what exactly the prosecution wanted the jury to take from that. Was the suggestion that Lindsay could do those things on her children's birthdays because she wasn't sufficiently grieving them? Or was part of the point to show this jury what her life at Tewksbury looks like, to make it feel comfortable, maybe even too comfortable, compared with what we imagine when we think about prison? But the defense did fill in another part of that picture. They pointed out that Lindsay remains under constant one-to-one observation because of concerns that she could attempt to take her own life. So, yes, a medical record might say that she watched TV or ate a snack that day, but that doesn't necessarily tell you what was happening inside of her mind while she was doing it. And there's a reason that I think all of this matters. Jurors are not supposed to decide guilt based on what punishment they think that Lindsay should receive, or based on where they think she should spend the rest of her life. Their job is to decide whether the Commonwealth has proven the charges under the law, including the issues surrounding criminal responsibility. But jurors are also human, and when you repeatedly paint a picture for them of what Lindsay's life may look like at a psychiatric hospital versus what they know life would look like if she were convicted and incarcerated, I just can't help but wonder whether that comparison starts creeping into the decision-making, even if it isn't supposed to be there. And ultimately, the verdict isn't supposed to answer the question, where does Lindsay Clancy deserve to be? It has to answer a much narrower legal question. What was her mental state when she killed the children? And under law, was she criminally responsible for what she did? Day 16 ended with an unusual potential witness, Emily Thorndike, a licensed clinical social worker who had previously worked at McLean Hospital for more than 7 years. Thorndike had been watching the trial, and after hearing Patrick's testimony about Lindsay's stay at McLean, she posted a TikTok saying that she thought the testimony gave a misleading picture of what treatment there can actually look like. That caught the defense's attention. They wanted Thorndike to explain how McLean actually operated, staffing levels, how much time patients typically spent with providers, and particularly what staffing could look like during weekends and holiday weeks, because Lindsay was admitted over New Year's. Essentially, the defense wanted to challenge the idea that because Lindsay spent 5 days at a prestigious psychiatric hospital and was discharged, she necessarily received this extensive evaluation that would have caught a serious psychiatric condition. But there was a problem. Thorndike had left McLean more than a year before Lindsay was admitted, so she had no firsthand knowledge of Lindsay's actual stay. The judge held a voir dire outside the presence of the jury to determine whether she could testify, and ultimately ruled that she couldn't. The defense could still use McLean's actual staffing records, but Thorndike herself would not be allowed to explain them to the jury. And that brings us to the end of another really important week in the Lindsay Clancy trial. We're finally getting to the experts and finally getting some opinions on the questions that really matter here. And for the first time, the defense began putting a clinical framework around all of those things that we've been hearing about for weeks. The insomnia, the racing thoughts, the dissociation, the suicidal ideation, the fear, the medications, and the moments when Lindsay seemed completely normal despite everything happening around her. And I think that leaves this jury with an incredibly difficult question. Was Lindsay, in that moment, capable of understanding the wrongfulness of what she was doing and controlling her behavior under the law. The defense still has a few witnesses left, and then the prosecution gets its opportunity for rebuttal. And after that, this case that we have spent weeks dissecting piece by piece will finally be handed to the jury. And when that happens, they're going to have to decide which version of January 24th makes sense when all of those pieces are finally put together. And I'll be right here covering it through till the very end. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator and host of the 13th Juror Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and leave a rating or review. It helps more listeners discover the podcast. And if you know someone who would find this case as fascinating as you did, share this episode with them. For additional episodes, case updates, and more information about the podcast, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com. The evidence has been presented, the arguments have been made, and now comes the same question faced by every juror. What do you believe? Thank you for listening.
Looking for your next thrifting experience? Check out the new Goodwill Columbus location in Westerville. Our new store is full of the latest secondhand selections with options rotating daily. From warm weather clothes to home decor, you may find your new favorite items just in time for spring. Each purchase helps us create opportunities throughout Central Ohio. It's shopping that looks good, feels good, and does good. Come shop at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
Hey, let's talk about something a lot of us deal with, thinning hair or hair loss. If that sounds familiar, CAPS has solutions. Their hair restoration treatments are personalized, designed to strengthen your existing hair, encourage regrowth, and improve scalp health. The providers at CAPS guide you every step of the way with advanced treatments for noticeable, long-lasting results. And when you book your first hair restoration appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.